Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. There are two main LA impresarios, the West Side, David Sefton, native of Liverpool, England, artistic director of UCLA Live, which happens in the Magisterial, Royce Hall, Froude Hall, and other spaces, and East Side, Mark Murphy, native of Staten Island, New York, executive director of Red Cat, Roy and Edna Disney CalArts Theater, located right up the street in the southwest corner of the Geary-designed Disney Hall. When you go to UCLA Live or Red Cat, you probably haven't seen the companies that are performing there on their stages. As Stephen Leigh Morris pointed out in the article in the LA Weekly, he said, unless it's a performance by Garrison Keillor, Ira Glass, or the Royal Shakespeare Company, the reason to go to UCLA Live or Red Cat is largely an act of faith in the sensibilities of Sefton and Murphy earned over years. So how did they earn that faith in their sensibilities? How do they find those Javanese puppet troupes, Argentinian dance companies, Congolese dance singer, cabaret singers? Well, I did just cross paths with Mark Murphy in Wrocław, Poland, at an eight-hour play about Andy Warhol. So I do happen to know that Mark and indeed David do spend a lot of time on the road. What kinds of risks are they willing to take? How do they develop an audience? How do you program adventurous theater in a recession like this? Those are some of the questions that we'll look at tonight. Mark Murphy is an influential leader in the national and international field of contemporary performing arts. Before he inaugurated Red Cat's programming, Mark served as artistic director from 1984 to 2001 at Seattle's Adventurous On the Boards. In Seattle, he created the Northwest New Works series and 12 Minutes Max, New Works and Works in Progress festivals, which were the model for Red Cat's studio series and the Now Festival. And he has over 20 years' experience producing, presenting, and developing new audiences for interdisciplinary performance. David Sefton is now finishing up his eighth season as artistic director of UCLA Performing Arts. Previously, David was head of contemporary culture at Royal Festival Hall in London, where he created and produced the annual Meltdown Festival, the largest and most influential festival in the center's season. His program at Royal Festival Hall focused on the development of music, performance, and multimedia, and was the recipient of several major awards. And in conversation with Mark and David tonight is veteran journalist Barbara Eisenberg, who is a regular contributor to the LA Times and Time Magazine and many other publications. Barbara's been a visiting scholar at the Getty Research Institute and is associate director of the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities at USC, which is a co-sponsor of this evening's program. Her books include Making It Big, The Diary of a Broadway Musical, and State of the Arts, California Artists Talk About Their Work, an essential text about creativity in the Golden State. And her new book, Conversations with Frank Gehry, which is due out next week, is already garnering rave reviews. This is a really exciting time for Barbara. The New York Times this morning called Conversations that it reveals an architect every bit as engaging as his buildings, and Library Journal calls her book a gold mine for scholars and the general public for generations. So we're very happy to welcome her here in this very special time. Please welcome Mark Murphy, David Sefton, and Barbara Eisenberg. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming, and we're delighted to have two really great impresarios here on stage, and you know about a little bit about both of what they do, and I thought that since both of you have come from somewhere else where you were already established as impresarios, I kind of wanted to get a sense of what lured you here to Los Angeles to do the same kind of very innovative work you had done elsewhere. And David Sefton, since you came the furthest, having come from London, maybe you can talk a little bit about what was appealing to you about going to UCLA and coming to Los Angeles. Well, not necessarily in that order.
Obviously. it rained an awful lot more in London. It was interesting having gone through, I'd gone through a 7-year cycle with starting the festival in London, and I was kind of ready for a new challenge. And in my background, I'd gone from doing more or less theatre with some music on the side to doing music with some other stuff on the side. And I'd really moved into doing a lot more music than anything else. And I really wanted to get back into a kind of mixed arts environment. And I had my interests lay in more areas than just the one. And I guess it just came along at the right time. It was a very, it was completely out of the blue. It was at UCLA, kept phones off. Who didn't know to do a cell phone announcement? I can do mine if you want. The idea. I mean, and to be perfectly honest, I knew nothing about the university system in this country being the place where the performing arts was really housed in most major cities. I knew nothing about the history of that. So I came very green to the first interview and really just came for a free trip. And realized I basically ran out of reasons not to come. Because they were very open, and I have to say, a complete kudos to UCLA. They've stood by this right through to giving me complete carte blanche with the program, which is very enticing.
Sorry, dude.
Go on. The program what?
But the program that you came into, I mean, just to kind of give a little background here, was a program that had been going on for 70 years.
No, 40. The hall is 70 years old.
Oh, it's the hall. Sorry.
Yeah. Royce Hall is 70 blah years old.
Okay, but the program, wasn't it like Duke Ellington and George Gershwin and all had been performing there?
There was absolutely nothing wrong with the UCLA program before I came in, and they'd done adventurous programming, but it was quite it was a very diplomatic program. It was kind of a little bit of something for everybody, and was not particularly charged with taking risks, even though it did take some. They brought me in with a remit specifically to come in and change it. I mean, I have to say, with full credit to my predecessor, it wasn't his job to go out and cause trouble, and they actually brought me in to cause trouble. Yeah, yeah.
Now, Mark, were you brought here to cause trouble? You were brought before there even was a Red Cat, weren't you?
It's true. So, Stephen Levine, the president of CalArts, invited me to come down and talk to him about Red Cat and talk with the people at CalArts. I was certainly aware of the notion of Red Cat. I'd read that it was going to be all things for all people and solve all the problems of the cultural ecology locally, nationally, and internationally.
All the problems not previously solved by the UCLA Live
right.
program.
That's right, because at that point I think David had been here. Well, your first full season hadn't actually...
No, I think they were talking to you before I was even...
And I had been very fond of L.A., especially after 17 years in Seattle. In the last winter there, it rained 93 days in a row. Although I figured if I went to L.A., I would have to do something else because there's no contemporary performance community there whatsoever. I'd been a couple of times a year to see certain things, and the community was not as developed as I would have liked. So I assumed that I would probably... I wanted to leave Seattle. I assumed I'd probably move to New York and live in a little box and run around doing what they do there.
Shouting.
Yes.
running and shouting. That's what they do.
And the notion of helping to start Red Cat and open another new theater after exactly 5 years after I had opened a new complex for On the Boards was very exciting. And... when I met the people who make up the community of working artists that is CalArts, I realized very quickly how many ideas and inspirers and artists we had in common. So I was thrilled. It sounded kind of easy.
Oh, before we get to how easy or hard it was, I think not everyone knows, one, what Red Cat stands for. I mean, I find it really interesting that it stands for the, let's see if I do it right. Okay, stop me if I'm wrong. The Roy and Edna Disney, what is it?
Red. Cal Arts.
Cal Arts.
I think Valencia.
Cal Arts, okay.
Theater.
Theater. That's what Red Cat stands for. So it's
Roy and Patty Disney gave a generous $5 million gift to help construct Red Cat. And
please say where it is. I mean, because not everyone even knows. It's kind of part of the whole Disney Hall complex.
Yeah, it was not part of the original design. We were actually 250 parking spots because it's a very L.A. story. They built the garage first and then 7 years later got around to actually managing to realize the building. And at the time that the Disney family was asked to be more involved in the continuing campaign for the Walt Disney Concert Hall, which had been initiated by a $50 million gift by Walt Disney's widow, Lillian Disney, the idea came up that perhaps we could also add a smaller space that would be a downtown home for CalArts. That, of course, had been a long tradition of a relationship between the Disney family and CalArts. It was Walt Disney's dream, although he didn't live to see it open. It was Roy, his brother, who actually opened CalArts in Valencia. Yet CalArts wanted an opportunity to be more engaged with the community. And Stephen Levine talks about wanting CalArts to be able to give something to the community to help people in Los Angeles be part of a larger dialogue about the evolution of new forms of art and performance that Los Angeles wasn't necessarily exposed to, except occasionally, perhaps during the blowout summer LA festival or sporadic opportunities here and there.
Well, just
forgot the question. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. No, really, all questions are the same. Say something interesting? Okay. And you're that was fine. Okay. So, but just to distinguish the two groups, both of your venues, just for a moment, CalArts is a small school. And I think the total enrollment's probably 1,200 for graduate and undergraduate.
Yeah, well, it sneaks up a little bit here and there as they find more closets to convert, but it's at 1,200 to 1,300, a small school. And Red Cat is a small theater
also. Red Cat's about 200 seats, which has flexible black box seating. On the other hand, David is dealing with a campus at which there are 35,000 students.
Yeah, something like that.
And the entire
certainly a lot of them. I can't say I've ever actually counted them. But.
No, fortunately you don't have to.
Yeah.
But I was thinking in the car that all of the students at CalArts could fit into Royce Hall easily because Royce Hall has 1,800 seats.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And can, quite happily. I mean, I'm happy to accommodate them whenever you want.
Well, I wanted to talk about how you program a season and how you find the groups you do. And I found a wonderful quote from you, David Sefton, in a Huffington Post blog you did at one point, where you said that for every 100 shows I see, there will be one that will be unequivocally fabulous.
Yeah.
And so
you don't want to know about the other 99.
But what I'd like to know, really, I think what's interesting is really kind of how you find that one in 100, you know?
There's a vast amount of frog kissing in our business. And even if you take the recommendations of colleagues and read the reviews and go on very strong word of mouth that reaches you, and there's a dozen different ways you find out about things, there's still only one in 100 shows that you really, really like. And I think, one in 100, I think, is actually...
That's generous. That's,
yeah, I know, absolutely.
You find the same, one in 100?
About 99.44% of the performances in the world suck.
Yeah. No, Mark is absolutely right. We speak with one voice on this. I should say that in terms of, and you know, there's a lot of trawling through this stuff that goes on. I'm really talking about theatre and the smaller scale performance, because I should say that we, for instance, our dance series goes into the 1800 seat room, so I am really dealing with stuff at a significantly better known level, even though we are trying to introduce in many cases names new to this environment or country or coast, but it is names that are already fairly substantially known in the rest of the world.
Well, not always. I mean, because I went to hear Moving Hearts
right.
at UCLA Live. I had never heard of them.
Right.
I had
but if
no
you were Irish, you would
no,
have
wait,
done.
But wait. However, I had never heard of them. And it was like one of the best concerts I'd ever heard.
Yeah.
You know, and even on that, I was wondering, like, for example, this was a group that had reunited, what, after 20 years or
yeah.
something?
Yeah.
Well, how did you find them? How did you find out that they had reunited? How did you get them to come here?
I mean, this is a kind of where I was going with the differentiation in the art forms, because I am responsible for all of them. So I do the music, classical, jazz, world, popular, whatever else. And I book the dance for the big room, and I book the spoken word. And so you really kind of, it's like one of those music hall plate juggling acts where you're kind of going, everything's okay. Oh no, jazz is slipping. Because you've really got to keep your eye on a lot of different things. But the traveling is predominantly for theatre and dance. I don't really travel to go to concerts. Mm-hmm. I know about, music is where I come from, so that's fortunate.
Oh, that one's easier.
I know a lot about particularly classical and more. I started the London Jazz Festival on the South Bank, so there are lots of things. In my background, there is lots of that stuff which I've just kind of accumulated over the years, like a big, scary wardrobe full of concert programs. It's sort of, that's my head, obviously. The new stuff tends to be in theatre and performance, rather. But I'm always out looking for new stuff in music as well, of course, but I'm travelling more for performance.
Well, I had originally asked David to bring his calendar with him because I was so curious as to how often you were on the road.
We both travel a lot, yeah. And often we bump into each other in Dublin, Buenos Aires, somewhere else. We
more
did
often
well.
Than in LA.
More often than in LA.
Well,
yeah.
But where are you going? Are you going to festivals? Are you mm-hmm. going to concerts? Are you going to meet with other impresarios? What are you doing there, Mark?
There are some countries that are very keen to invite American producers and presenters to come and see work at festivals. And I rely on their invitations sometimes because our travel budget is so limited. But it's an opportunity to see work from all around the world. You'll see five or six things in a day. It makes for an exhausting week, but it's very important research. Naturally, you're seeing work that's filtered through the eyes of a colleague, so the festival you're going to, you evaluate based on how well you know the programmer. Although there are other opportunities, such as the International Network of Contemporary Performance, also known as the Informal European Theater Meeting, which is a gathering of colleagues, and it's a chance to hear about projects. And the host country or city, usually a future cultural capital of Europe, although they're also holding meetings now in Korea, China, and Japan, will turn over the city and its various cultural venues to artists from that region. So it's a chance to see lots of things because it's and it may be years before one of the projects that you saw there that moved you and seemed like a match actually appears in your season. Sometimes it's just seeing an artist that you note as someone to really keep track of and wait till the right opportunity arises.
Well, give us an example. I mean, is there someone, say, on the season this year that you've been kind of waiting for?
Yeah. What are we doing this year?
What about the jazz pianist, Myra, a few weeks ago who performed?
It was absolutely lovely.
I'm sorry. Wait.
What was her name, Mark?
No. I have her name here somewhere.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that was instance, and this is something I should point out, too, is that was an instance where I have the benefit of, and the delicate challenge of working collaboratively with some of my colleagues. In this instance, someone who for years, there's other people keeping a list also. In the case of CalArts, there are many of the projects we present especially in music, almost 70% of our music is by composers or performers who are invited to be in residence and do workshops at CalArts, and then as the culmination of that will perform at Red Cat.
70%?
About 70% of what we do during the academic year is the result of not just a straight presentation, but actually the presentation of or premiere of a new work developed in residence.
So you're kind of getting the benefits before the performance. I mean, you're getting they're training, they're working with students. So is there also like a lingering kind of impact afterwards? I mean, do they?
Yeah, one of the remarkable things is that the longer residencies, the meaningful interaction between students and faculty, help to change everybody's lives. So much more than a one-night stand might. Some of the alumni from CalArts or elsewhere, when they talk about some of the most memorable moments in their life, they as much as they revere and respect their mentors and their faculty, they remember this incredible opportunity to work directly with someone that they've always respected.
Like Robert Wilson or...
An example, we had a chorus of 20 voices who collaborated or performed with Meredith Monk as part of a recent project with her. And they worked intently with her over the course of a week. And she is an incredibly generous spirit. And to be in a room with her for a week can be a life-changing experience to understand someone so devoted and so passionate about their art as a spiritual activity, that it's a learning experience. It can change the approach to one's craft or passion.
Well, actually, while you're on Meredith Monk, is this the performance that was at Stanford first?
Yeah.
And because that to me was amazing that there was a world premiere of this Meredith Monk and Hamilton production at Stanford, and within 2 weeks it was at CalArts. How long in advance did you have to plan something like that?
But in this case. And I should acknowledge that a previous Anne Hamilton and Meredith Monk collaboration was featured at one of David's seasons.
Thank you, Mom. My first season, actually.
Yeah, that's right. But in this case, through the Transatlantic Consortium, see, we're always also trying to find little pots of money wherever we can to try and make this possible.
Yeah, we're going to get to money. Don't worry.
But there was a commissioning opportunity and collaboration between Dartington Hall in the UK and Idlewild and CalArts. Called the Transatlantic Consortium, invested, was a significant commissioning partner in the Meredith Monk piece. So it was, the Stanford was also a commissioner. The idea that it would be at Stanford Lively Arts, and then there was a site-specific version of it done in Northern California, and then it came here the following week. It was great to do it so soon after its premiere, but it's usually not something I try to arrange. I mean, I've been offered world premieres before and said, actually, if we could wait 6 months when it's ready, that would be great.
Now, on the other hand, now you, when you brought over the Lear, the mm-hmm. Royal Shakespeare Company, as I understand, you brought over the Lear production without, there hadn't even been a rehearsal yet.
No, it didn't exist.
It didn't exist?
Basically, I got the phone call saying, would you like Sarie and McKellen in Trevor Nunn's production of King Lear? I said, well, just let me think about that for a minute. Yes, please. and there are certain things, but you just kind of... there is such a thing as a justifiably blind faith. And actually, and as Mark points out, part of the commissioning process is you commit to things that you haven't seen. And he's right also in saying you'd rather have them halfway through or towards the end of the tour than at the start. But no, that piece completely did not exist. And it was... It was production of that size, it was relatively late in the day when we got the call. It was only a year or so before the actual production, which for something that size, really you tend to know, the conversation could be 2 or 3 years long for something like that. For a lot of the things that end up on our season, it has been at least a 3-year conversation by the time they get there.
Well, have there been situations like that where it's been a 3-year conversation and then it disappears?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All the time. All the time.
Yeah.
I mean, things just get out of control, or you suddenly realize that you're going to have to sell your house to pay for them. And sometimes there will be a hypothetical conversation which happens long before there is a budget, and then the budget is $1 million and you just can't do it. I mean, and there are limitations. But I mean, we all have... No matter how big your festival gets or whatever scale your budget is at, we all hit the wall at a certain point.
Or you follow the artist's work, hoping it's going to continue to grow, and it goes in a different direction.
Yeah.
And that can be. In other words, it grows down.
And yeah, eventually they may be removed from the list or put on a
different list,
a more passive list of action items.
Well, one, I mean, I was thinking about the, like, for example, the Munich Symphony Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, what, 104 people in an orchestra? I think it's 102 or 100.
Somewhere between 80 and 150. Yeah. Yes.
And I was thinking, what will happen to a performing group that's touring like that in this recession?
The example of orchestras is a very good one. I was actually all set in my bold stupidity to start an international orchestra series next year. Four of the six orchestras I had booked cancelled their American tours because of money, basically. And actually, one was a whole other story, which I can't have on a podcast. But orchestras are one of those groups that are really feeling the pinch because, as you say, even if they have a 15-city tour of people prepared to pay $100,000 or whatever it is, it's enormously expensive to put those people on the road for that time. And sometimes, especially currency variations can really hit you. And ironically, sometimes they can hit you even when the dollar going strong again can hit you badly, but when the dollar collapses, as happened in recent times, suddenly what they are getting paid in pounds or euros is not worth them leaving the house for. There's a lot of factors, and in fact, orchestras are a pretty good example where it's a very, very large group of people on the road. But we do. I mean, I should point out that on a season like mine, I am not out making approaches on my own to an orchestra. That is a situation where you inevitably must work with one of the big agencies who are the people that tour groups on that scale, and you will be approached by a Columbia artists or an IA. Well, there's a whole
as
bunch.
It's part of a world tour, US tour.
Normally there'll be a US tour, and you will be asked if you want to be part of it, because you can't take on that kind of thing alone.
Well, what was your kind of favorite? I know neither of you can talk about next. Can you talk about next year's season? I know he can't.
Some.
Okay. Well, maybe.
Trying to remember which one.
I know. Tell me about it.
What is? Yeah. But yeah, to some extent.
Yeah, because I thought that. Okay, let's start with yours then, and then maybe David will want to say something about next season.
If you embargo the podcast till the 3rd of June.
Right. Because I know it's always a big event to kind of announce it all. Let's start with Mark then. Do you have a sense of what might be coming next year?
Yeah, there's actually a few projects that have been on various lists for a while that we're able to do now. Some of them are artists I've worked with before, and some I'm working with for the first time. I'm very happy to have a chance for Meg Stewart, an American choreographer based in Brussels now, to be seen in L.A., because
she's
someone whose work should really be seen.
Mm, yeah, no, she's great. Very good. Excellent. Good choice. Very good choice. Go and see Meg Stewart. Full approval there.
I've had a chance to work with her before, and she's... it started because there was an opportunity. She was going to be on the West Coast, but now it turns out, because of a change in their date, she now has to go back to Brussels and then come back out here, but at least the set is still here. A really fun project that I'm going to be running longer than I normally would is a collaboration between puppeteer Basil Twist and performance artist... drag cabaret extraordinaire character Joey Arias, called Arias with a Twist, which had a very successful run in tiny little Here Art Center in New York. It's a puppet extravaganza show. And in the process, after I'd seen it, after
puppet,
we started talking specifics,
yeah.
It's a, what did I say it was?
No, you said puppet extravaganza. I don't know. It struck me
it
as
is.
Amusing.
Oh, it's giant minimalist.
Yeah.
Giant minimalist. I like that.
And I midpoint through the negotiations for this, or the discussion, not negotiations, trying to figure out how we could possibly do it. Because it's not a negotiation if you start at zero, only if you're going down from a price that was mentioned.
If they're paying you afterwards.
Yeah. I found that Basil and I are third cousins that are great, great, great grandparents or siblings in Portland, Oregon in 1858.
How the hell did that come up?
Well, there's a section.
Sorry, I'm stepping in.
There's
a section
really
in the piece where he has a series of puppets and he recreates the Griff Williams Orchestra. And
right.
He said, "This is my grandfather's orchestra." My grandfather and I thought,
fantastic.
My mom used to talk about the Griff Williams Orchestra, and every Saturday night or Friday night, they would broadcast from the top of the Mark Spencer, or whatever the hotel was in San Francisco. Is it the same Griff Williams? Well, yes. Oh, well, you're part of the Williams family. Oh, well, I'm part of the Dunn family. Oh, well, great-grandfather Williams. Blah, blah, blah.
Hang on, not the... No, I'm just kidding. just kidding.
Cousin. and now the families are... I have a great uncle who documented the family as much as possible.
Okay.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful.
And it is good the two of us are in town, because I have to say I do draw the line of drag puppets.
Well, puppets are iffy. Drag is spotty, but together it's a
nightmare. Absolute living hell. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, now, who are you programming for? I mean,
ourselves.
Know. No, I mean, isn't that true? I mean, isn't
yes,
to
you
a
have
large
to draw,
extent?
Yes, you're driven by your enthusiasm. So, in many ways, I mean, when I first started, I got this, like, almost written in crayon abusive letter from somebody who'd seen the LA Times interview and who said, it's just like you're forcing your taste down our throats. And I wrote back and said, that is my job description. And I do believe you have to take a line on this stuff. There's no point just taking the middle of the road, because then you're going to get run over both ways. I mean, you really have to have a view. You have to have an opinion. I mean, we are meant to curate these things. So I make no apologies for like.
Well, it goes
with
back
enthusiasm.
To what Louise was saying in the introduction about the act of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if someone's going to UCLA Live, they're making a good bet that they're going to have taste which is similar to yours,
and
or be open. To
I
your
think
taste.
Openness
and
is
similarly,
what you're looking for.
Similarly to yours.
That's why it was so scary for an organization like Red Cat to have to appear fully grown all of a sudden in a new building. That doesn't happen. Usually an organization that's been around 15 or 20 years might get a new shiny shell. Mm. But
that's quite an interesting discussion, though, about whether it's more difficult to start from scratch with your vision or come in and try and change vision that was previously occupied by somebody
else.
Well,
there's that. Well,
because there are
all of that chamber music.
exactly.
So
why
much?
Have you canceled cabaret is the question I get often asked.
Yeah.
Because it's really, really horrible is what I'm
saying. now, who is in the audience? I mean... Is your audience primarily CalArts students? I mean, I notice that the age level drops when I go to Red Cat from
when
I'm...
Yeah, it's a young audience. It's a young audience and it's quite diverse. The people in the audience I think of the most are artists. And I have a little more freedom to do that than David because I have fewer seats. And can work with artists. Part of our mission being to introduce audiences here, including artists and students, to some of the most influential artists in the world. And by influence, I mean in order to be part of this larger discussion about the evolution of these art forms, you really need to know who Meg Stewart is. You need to be able to be familiar with the development of the work of the Wooster Group. It's important
or
to
Yvonne
see.
Or Yvonne Rainer.
Austin Linyakula.
Yeah, Yvonne Rainer will be... Will she be there, or the troupe,
yeah.
or... In June, we'll be at Red Cat.
Yeah. And that's a collaboration with the Getty. The Getty actually brought that to us. She's an artist that they have been working with. So that's another collaboration. That's another thing to put it. About a third of our events are collaborations with other organizations or independent artists.
Have you collaborated?
Access, for instance.
Have you ever collaborated, the two of you?
Not yet.
No, we haven't had the...
We had conversations about one artist where it's about what makes sense, really. Because if I'm bringing a large company in, and there was one conversation about a company specifically who wanted to come in and do one very small scale piece and one very large scale piece.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now that's where it would make absolute sense for us to talk. Right. And we did talk to each other, but that project never happened. Not because we don't get on, but because they never came. But I think there would have to be very specific circumstances. I know there's one person that we're both interested in, and he won't fit in either of our spaces. So there's a conversation to be had about whether or not we do approach that together.
Could you do it here?
No, because it's for the season after next. If I can't talk about 9, 10, I certainly can't talk about 10, 11.
It'll be at Red Cat.
No, I'm kidding. Only if he knocks it down and rebuilds it as a warehouse space.
I'm kidding. Sometimes it's just a financial issue.
You'd have to take the whole parking lot for what we're talking about. We both know what we're talking about.
Oh, that one. Oh, right. So there's a couple. Yeah. No, I don't think that one will... I should tell you.
Because I can't afford it either. We both know what we're talking about, but it's really annoying, isn't it? Well, because we're the only ones who know.
No, that's... if you did it for much longer, it would be.
Yeah,
but we're going to stop.
I got that myself. I started to irritate myself.
Well, I've seen it twice.
And I haven't seen it at all. But I've been talking to the director for 6 years.
No, on something,
but the
you may get that fight that we've never had in a minute.
No, but see, I mean, but that's actually part of the whole discussion. I mean, for all you know, Michael Ritchie, you know, is sitting somewhere right now in a bar with that director saying, you know, this is perfect for the taper.
I would bet you 12 months' salary that he's not.
No.
No. The reimagining the Douglas again is a great opportunity.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right, let's go back.
Just not podcast this at all.
Artists of the audience. And actually, you gave me an opportunity to mention other things you're doing next year that might exemplify this notion of inspiring artists. I mentioned the Wooster Group as a theater ensemble,
right.
I'm especially
fond of.
Now,
the Wooster Group, they were at UCLA Live this
year, weren't
they?
They came to me in 2002 at the first theater festival.
Yeah, and that was one of the examples of, he's doing All My Friends, who's going to be left? Because I had been working with them on various projects since 86 or so.
Yeah.
But there was no way... You know, if and I didn't know David that well then, but there was no way if it became a bidding war that I could possibly win because they're expensive as it is. As it turns out, the next project was a perfect fit for us and not as I believe not as much of a fit for you. And they fell so in love with the specifics of our physical space and our audience and our specific niche and all of that that this relationship was renewed, and they recently received some national funding to establish a longer-term relationship with Red Cat and CalArts so that over 3 years they'll be here on an annual basis with one project or another.
Well, and there are certain things that definitely just fit better into Mark's space than to mine. I mean, and when we do, the Wooster Group is the perfect example. We had to basically build a seating block on stage at the Froude Playhouse because of the configuration they need. Mark has the kind of flexible space that makes it much easier for a Wooster Group to go in. I have major venue envy with the flexibility of his space. He has venue envy with the ticket income I get. But I have very fixed venues, and I mean my saving grace with the Playhouse is that the stage is so big that I can put the audience up there. But it's a major pain in the neck.
Do you have kind of like a free reign of whatever facilities you might want at UCLA, or just those two? The Froude
Royce Hall, I manage the book. The calendar is mine. I run the building for all of that, and my staff and the team is responsible for the building, what goes in there, the rental. So I have the run of that calendar. The Froude Playhouse is a theater, film, and television school building that I rent off them. I'm their biggest renter, I think, for like 3 or 4 months of the year. And those are the two main spaces we use. There's a little studio space that's about the same size as Red Cat. But again, it's a fixed space. It's not a studio space. I don't have a black box space on campus. And occasionally we take things off campus, and we've done the odd thing very successfully off campus as well. Mainly when there was a real need for a completely flexible space, like when we produced Osseous Labyrinth. You hear Mark? Who are local crazy people who were working
as opposed to
international crazy people. Who I really wanted to work with and who just could not work in a traditional space, and we went to a soundstage down in Marina Del Rey, Venice, and it was a very successful enterprise. For the most part, though, it's really about identifying. We are part of the UCLA campus, and so I couldn't just go off campus and do everything off campus if I want. It's really about Royce Hall, and the Playhouse, for the most part, works extremely well. And the scale of the work we're doing in the Froude, like the Volkspooner or Robert Wilson or Raphael Sanzio
or Lepage.
I mean, they need the capacity and the bigness of the space, whereas there are other groups that are just delighted to be in a flexible, much more kind of contemporary space like Mark's.
Maybe let's stay on the theater festival for a minute, because I know that's something that gives you great joy.
Oh, absolutely.
And kind of... How did that come about? Did you have any trouble persuading anyone at UCLA
at all. I mean, as I say, when I came in, it was very explicit that they wanted this shift and they wanted the programming to be taken in different directions. And I actually identified the presentation of international theatre as a priority for me in the interview, so it really didn't come as a surprise, or shouldn't have done if they were listening.
Yeah.
And I did a little bit of sporadic programming in my first season, but built into launching a theater festival in the fall of 2002. And that, I mean, I really kind of laid down the ground, because we brought from Italy, we brought Societas Raffaello Sanzio twice in the same festival, who are definitely one of the most radical theater companies on the planet. Wilson was presented in Los Angeles for the first time, in spite of what Mark Sweden said in the Los Angeles Times. Wojciech was the first Robert Wilson shown in this town, not Madame Butterfly. That was when the Wooster Group came. We presented Heiner Goebbels in this town, possibly this coast, for the first time. And so we really kind of laid down, but we did not call it, I didn't want to call it anything like Next Wave or Contemporary anything, because we also do the RSC and the Globe and Piccolo Teatro Milano. And my specific charge was just finding the best work, as opposed to the most modern and groundbreaking. It happens that a lot of it that I regard as the best work is also the best groundbreaking, modern, contemporary, and challenging work. But I reserve the right to do very, very good traditional work as well.
Now, you're also introducing some of this work to the States. I mean, you're not just introducing it to the Los Angeles audience, you're bringing them to America.
Yeah.
To North America.
Yeah.
So, do you then work with, say, BAM or with other organizations
sometimes
around the country?
Sometimes it's just us. Sometimes it really is just us who are the. We seek partners. I don't kind of sort of secrete my program away and refuse to talk to anybody else about it. Often our partners are Canadian. I find that a lot of the people doing some of the same programming, particularly in dance, actually in contemporary dance, when we brought Sidi Larbi, his company, to the States for the first time, October just gone, it was three Canadian presenters and us, and we were the only American date. And that was great, because we put a very, very well-known dance artist on the international circuit with his own company in America for the first time. And we sold 2,500 tickets over two nights, which was great. And Sidi Larbi was absolutely delighted. And a lot of people who saw him, the interesting thing was, people came up to me, and about 10 different people came up to me and said, this is what it felt like when I first saw Pina Bausch, which was really, and the kind of work that I'm doing in the big space in dance is intended to be like that. You are supposed to feel that to equate it with the excitement of seeing great artists. And people came up to me after Castellucci and said, this guy is the next Robert Wilson, blah, blah. And there's a lot of that excitement. And what's been great is that, I mean, for 2 years, many very learned people in this town told me categorically I was going to fail in the presentation of international work, and that Los Angeles audiences wouldn't come and see work that was surtitled. They wouldn't come and see work in a foreign language. There was no audience. And I just used to say, well, how do you know? Because at that point, there wasn't even Red Cat. So there wasn't. It was,
well, they only had, I mean, there was the Olympic Arts Festival.
Which was in 1984.
Right, in 1984. And at that time, there were all of these, you know, great productions in foreign languages. But it seemed to me that it was always the same people who were supporting all of them. It wasn't like there were enough audiences to support more than one.
And it was a one-off, and they spent a gazillion dollars on a fantastic program and probably the biggest marketing campaign ever seen for the arts in this town. The thing that I constantly got after we did the second theater festival, and I swear 60 or 70 people said this to me, oh, you're doing it again. So the idea that something would come back again the next year was not very L.A., because really what LA does is like big slash and burn festivals that then go away. And with us, it's seasons. It's not a one-off. And it's about sustainability and growing and building that audience. And I'm happy to say that all those people that told me it would fail were wrong.
That's good. Now what influence?
Yeah, so far.
What influence, if any, does having all of that theater here have on other theater companies here? Have you sensed, or on theater going here, or has there been any kind of like a other impact that they've had besides the people who sit in the theater and see the shows? Has it also kind of expanded and spilled over into other theater companies? Or
you like to hope so, I think.
I hope so, and I think so. Sometimes it takes longer than you might think. Mm-hmm. I thought by now 5 years of Red Cat, 5.5 years, 6 years of a very different programming approach at UCLA, that the artist community here, not that they should emulate and copy what they're seeing, but that they might, you might observe noticeable branching out or perhaps acknowledging the importance of a more dramaturgical approach to dance, for instance, or something that can only...
Or taking risks. They might notice that taking risks is a good idea.
Risks. But it has happened somewhat. I think there's been an increase in not to sound rude, but in the sophistication, meaning in the term of that word, not that it was unsophisticated before, but perhaps it was less current.
I think what's quite interesting is looking at the ebb and flow of that kind of thing around the emergence of one strong personality. If I've heard it once, I've heard it 1,000 times. What a shame Razor Abdo isn't still here. And one person clearly was responsible for driving an awful lot of what was completely groundbreaking and innovative for that moment and that time. Mm-hmm. And yes, I mean, I've only seen the videos. I wasn't even in this country then. And yes, I can absolutely understand why that had such an impact at the time. But I think I feel we've yet to see that, the next Razor Abdo in this. And we will. I think Mark's right. What you'd hope is that, I have no expectation that somebody's going to turn around and go, I saw Castellucci in 2002, and now I'm going to form my own completely off-the-wall theatre company. But you hope that just by exposure, the range of stuff that you're pointing out there, that there will be a positive effect.
I came down to see pretty much everything Reza did. He was a singular artist in the community. One of the challenges, too, is that there still is really, in theatre and in dance, almost no alternative to self-production, so that the people who are staging their own work are renting the theater, and they're believing what these 60 or 70 people had said to David, that people won't buy tickets to something if it's too
weird.
Unusual.
Yeah.
And they're so often so focused on what will be popular that they're not thinking about what it is they actually want to say. And so in the rare opportunities when we're able, like with our summer festival, to remove some of that stuff from their plate and let them focus on the work, I think we begin to see some growth.
Now, just to throw in money for a second then.
Please.
Well, I mean,
both. You could all throw money.
Yeah.
Both of your organizations, commission work as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering that not only is it expensive to produce work, but if you're commissioning work, it's it's extremely expensive.
Yeah.
Will that be cut back a lot now because of the fact there is no money for anything at all?
I was really lucky that the RSC came in the year it did, because I used the RSC profit for the biggest commissioning thing UCLA has ever got involved in. And I completely redeployed that money into something very contemporary, which will come in the next festival. But next year, there ain't no there.
There's no RSC next year?
There's something that might actually end up generating something like that should things turn around a wee bit by mid-September of this year. But in terms of what I've got at my disposal, it is the first thing to go, I think, for all of us, because there's no income attached to it. And it's really important that you get involved in that process, because it's your active participation in not just keeping your fingers crossed, traveling and hoping to see good work.
It's bringing it.
It's putting your money where your mouth is. It's saying to artists, I'm giving you this money to help you create this work. And it's always consortium. I've never been in a position to be the sole commissioner of a major piece. I mean, in the piece that we put, the largest pot of money we ever put in, it was €1 million to make this particular piece of work. So, I think what Mark alluded to is absolutely correct. In this country, there's no structure for companies to have that kind of luxury where huge amount of money is being poured in, certainly not in this town, where there is enough money around to make those companies feel able to take the risks necessary.
The idea of putting a big pot of money into a project is difficult to justify when you're trying to make ends meet so much, although you hope there's a way to help to still contribute to the, we don't want to have a lost decade where artists aren't able to realize their work. I've been trying to imagine ways of collaboration with artists that can help support their work in other ways. For instance, we opened our theater season this year with a project by Elevator Repair Service. They did not have a touring version of the set for this very successful production that had run in New York, and they desperately wanted one because they saw there could be a long life for this production. They estimated it would cost $35,000 to build this set, and I didn't have that. But we were able to get a local real estate investor, Seth Pollan, to give us access to warehouse space for 6 weeks. We were able to get Anawalt Lumber to donate some lumber and some other materials. I have two of the most brilliant, amazingly creative carpenters and technical minds working for Red Cat. We built them a beautiful touring set, and I think it's in Portugal now. And so we were able to do build the $35,000 set for, I think, $10,000, and half of that we would have spent on shipping out here anyway. That's an example of a sort of barter, find creative resources to contribute. And they're calling us a commissioning.
Well, you are. You're commissioning. So we are commissioning, but set. Mm-hmm. No cash. You know.
And we've had there are a couple of other artists who have done that too, given residency time or some other opportunity. And I think maybe going forward in the next few years, that may be, collaboration between organizations.
All of these new things that you hadn't, you have to constantly be finding new ways to support the arts.
Mm-hmm. I certainly don't want to be in full retreat mode. I don't think that's something we can survive.
I think that's an actually good place to open the floor to questions. and we have a microphone right there. Man in the blue shirt.
God, I hope there are no drag puppeteers in the audience.
let's talk about when you were young. How did you get started on this?
What do you mean, when?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
younger.
Babyhood. Okay, no, early impulses to be an impresario. What made you a producer rather than, or were you an actor, were you a director, were you a writer? Or tell us about that.
Well, in my case, I never wanted to be nor considered myself an impresario, although once the Canadians put it on a name tag that they gave me. And that was sort of a thrill. And at first I thought, oh, I can't wear this. And then I realized all my other colleagues who... I earned it, I figured. my mother was an artist, my father was an actor. I took tap dance lessons, and we were the Murphy Four, and even appeared on TV in New York at one point. But my tap dance career, hung up my tap shoes at about age 10.
What's it going to cost? I can give you an opening slot at Rose Hall.
I included it on my resume when I was an actor for a while, and I was at once asked, could you do a triple time step, please? Oh,
yeah, no.
No? Sorry, that was a very long time ago.
Oh, damn.
I was involved in more traditional forms of theater, mostly as an actor and director, but actually became quite bored with the idea, especially once I started working as an actor and realized I was going to have to do this 6 nights a week for 6 weeks. I never met the guy who wrote it. How could you possibly stay interested in that? And I began to realize there must be another way to tell a story, and became more interested in working on developing new work. And it was also at a time when we were beginning to see for the first time, this is early 80s, video available to individuals as opposed to just big companies. And that became, so the idea of using images in different ways and electronics in different ways was very exciting to me. The mix of dance and theater to create different forms, very exciting to me, and it just kind of stuck.
My father was a cop. My mother was a housewife. I've never done anything except the arts. I've never had a proper job in my life. I'm just some kind of weird genetic throwback, some changeling character that no one ever quite knew why. I've never done anything except the arts. And that includes acting and musical stuff and singing in a punk rock band and playing in orchestras and being an arts journalist. Just about every possible thing you can do in the arts. But I just kind of sort of floated into this. But I've never, ever done anything else. I don't think I'm actually capable of getting a proper job.
I was a lobbyist for a few years, but it's really the same job.
But who first suggested that you do this, that you put on some festival show or group? I mean, how did
no
you
idea.
There was no such job that existed.
No, exactly.
It wasn't a career that existed at the time we started just doing it until we looked back and realized that other people were doing it too.
It's true. And students ask this question all the time, of course. As students are always saying, so how do you get your job? And it's like, oh, I don't know. You ought to spend 25 years doing mad other things and then somehow you're here. Each and every single person in a job like these jobs has a different path or story of how they got there.
Actually, Cameron McIntosh, you may know this story. When Cameron McIntosh, the producer of Les Mis and Phantom of the Opera and probably...
Loads of other rubbish.
Loads of other what? I'm sorry.
Nothing.
When he,
a lot of musicals. Let's
a lot
just
of
leave it at that.
Many musicals. When he was a tyke, he was like 6, 7 years old. His mother took him to the theater. And when the show was over... He insisted that his mother get somebody to take him backstage because he wanted to see how it happened. And then he was just hooked from that point on, unless it's apocryphal.
I was forced to play the Tin Man when I was 5 years old at infant school. That's probably the moment.
Do you have like a something that you really, really want to do at either of your venues that
Yeah, we both have the same answer, but we can't tell you it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, besides that, besides Monsieur X or Madame X, or have like a kind of something that's like an elusive dream image of what you like to see on your stage?
There's always stuff. The year that I worked out that I could either have a theater festival or Ariane Mnuchin, because Ariane Mnuchin was going to cost exactly the same amount, uncannily enough, it was just shy of $1 million, as my entire theater festival, 6 or 7 other international companies, was the time I realized it was unlikely that I was going to work with Ariane Mnuchin. But she did cook me lunch, which is one for the memoirs. So, I mean, there are always things which are outside of your reach. And no matter what your reach is, there's always something outside of it.
That's
and
good.
Usually it's financial.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just a project that won't fit in a normal theater or can't be recreated. Financially, I have sort of a rule. Once you realize that you could actually fly the entire audience to wherever the show is being done for the cost it would be to present it, then you have to think about what you're doing.
Oh, no. The Mnuchin, we could have chartered a plane and put everybody up in a hotel overnight from the entire food audience for the week, and it would have been cheaper than doing the show.
Yeah. That's when you have to.
That's when you have to go.
Pause.
No.
Hi, I was just wanted to ask both of you, as curators, to if you'd stick your necks out and say what work that you've seen in your life you just absolutely loved. I mean, just talk about one that got to you. I mean, you didn't have to schedule it, book it, but just something that got to you as a curator, as an audience member.
Rafael Isanzio, I already mentioned, and I actually started the theater festival.
Could you describe it a little bit to get
into
the
came.
Passion?
It opened my first theater festival in 2002. It was called Genesi. It was a three-act piece. When I saw it in London, there was that deeply unsettling sense of not really having a clue what was going on and realizing that it was because I'd never actually seen anything that had that same theatrical language, and it was off-putting in ways and weird in others and deeply intellectual. And overall, I walked away thinking, that's one of the greatest pieces of theater I've ever seen in my entire life. And it was abstract and alienating, and there are still people in this country that say to me, did you really bring it off that piece? It was contentious, and it pissed people off, all the things the theatre is supposed to do. And I opened my first theatre festival with it, and it was the only thing that I wanted to open my first theatre festival with, because I realised that one of the responses, as well as the people saying, no one will come to foreign theatre, there was also, I was getting a very wishy-washy response when I tried to talk up theatre in this town. And then I went to some of the more conventional theatre-producing houses and realised that that's because they thought I meant that. And the thing is, there is a completely different language of theatre that is barely ever seen, definitely in this town, I mean, and certainly often in this country, that is much more And there was one of my board members who had been in my when we take over a job, well, when one takes over a job where you have a previous director, you take over their season, obviously, because it's booked a year out. And I slotted a few things in to say, kind of, here I am, into the existing year. And we put on this piece called Charlie Victor Romeo, which was a piece, was dramatizations of black box recordings from plane crashes and near misses. Stunning piece of work that 9/11 pretty much put paid to, although it is now being done again. Just set in a cockpit, and no one had ever taken the actual notations of black box recordings and done them. They do all these safety conferences now because they use them for pilot training. Anyway, I was in a conversation with one of my board members, and they were going, well what do you mean by theatre? And they obviously were thinking, oh no, sorry, I won't name names, something completely different. And I said Charlie Victor Romeo, because it had happened by this point. And they said, oh, we went to that. Was that theatre? And there was that, and you really were starting from, and I realized then that when I said theatre, I had some explaining to do. And that's fine. It's good to know that, because I was kind of like, why is no one else excited about my International Theatre Festival? And it was that sense of actually communicating that when you say theatre, you don't necessarily mean straight text conveyed, pointing at the audience and shouting, that when the minor bit part player from soap opera walks on stage, everyone applauds. So there are different interpretations of theatre than what is often taken to be meant when you use that word.
I think there's three artists that are most endlessly fascinated by. One would be the Wooster Group, and my first experience with them is their piece LSD, and then St. Anthony, I think, was another one. Those two were absolutely stunning. In dance, I am so honored to have presented on several occasions Kazuo Ono, solo performer, one of the founders of the Budo form, and I find him to be sheer poetry and actually, you know, absolutely awe-inspiring. He's now 90 something, and the last time I saw him perform, he fell twice. I fear we'll never see him dance again, and that's a tragedy. And the other artist from the other coast, I think that has made me, it moved me to tears more often than almost anybody, is Anna Teresa de Kiersmacher, the Belgian choreographer, who Mark Morris, when he was in Europe, used to refer to jokingly as Anna Teresa de Tearjerker.
Perhaps, is there? Okay, go ahead.
Oh, okay. L.A. is commonly referred to as a town, an audience, to put it in large terms, as a of star effers. Do you find that to be true? And compared to your past experience, either in Seattle or the U.K., is there a difference? Or is that something universal, that that people generally are prone to that?
I mean, luckily, there's an informality about the way Red Cat is set up, that the even when we've got legendary figures like, you know, Lou Reed or something like that, it's not, we don't have as much security issues. Although we have shared stories about wealthy celebrities who call wanting comps for sold-out shows and expecting you to say yes.
But you don't.
No. That can go on the please webcast this. No. I think rich people. I suggested to UCLA that there was a tax introduced for celebrities wanting tickets, where they paid more than everybody else because of the extra effort involved in servicing their needs and hiding them backstage and bringing them in with coats over their heads so everyone notices them. And they didn't go for the tax thing, but no one famous gets in for nothing. People said about the McKellen Lear, which did create this insane feeding frenzy. It did everywhere. I mean, that happened in New York, and that happened at the Guthrie. It's L.A., yes, there is that factor in L.A., but I think it's everywhere. I think there's just more of them here. That's the difference, I think.
I don't mean just the people who are the celebs, but the public will only go to things
that... Oh, you pick someone.
Yeah.
Is more of more of them will go. I think they won't only go. We'd both be screwed if that was true. Oh, okay.
I think it's sort of an event town more so than many places. That when you're thinking about how to describe something, you really have to make an extra effort to make sure they understand, you know, what a rare opportunity this is and how they want to be the first one on their block to have this, you know, slicer dicer.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Is there someone with a question?
There's a brewing down here. There you go. You know,
I'm wearing USC covers, as your chancellor pointed out to me last night. My question to you is, have you considered Broadway downtown to extend your brand? We have a lot of theaters from empty shells completely rotted out as black boxes to gorgeously finished 2,300-square-foot palaces.
And the answer is emphatically yes, I have. We went a long way down the road with one venue that we brought in the UCLA risk assessment, and it was absolutely uninsurable as a live performance venue because the fire curtain didn't work, and it would have cost $100,000 to fix the fire curtain. So, one of the problems I had when I first came in, I definitely jumped the gun. In 2000, I was going to start a rock festival on Broadway. And my custodians, who for the most part live in Compton or Inglewood, refused to come downtown. And I was told by the bands that their fans would not come downtown. Now, there's been a quantum shift downtown in the last 10 years. And I would love to do... If I have venue envy with Red Cat, I walk in and out of those theatres down Broadway, like, salivating openly. A lot of them simply do not work for theatre because they're not... The stages aren't big enough, they don't have adequate flying, they don't have wing space. You could really only put... What's happening with places like the Orpheum is what can happen. They're putting bands on. Because they're not built as theatres. You'd have to spend so much money putting in the infrastructure to do theatre that it's not viable. I love those theatres. And I think the thing that really terrifies me about what's going on downtown is inevitably, as it gets more successful, unless there's a really serious rear guard action, more and more of those places are going to end up as real estate. I really hope that I'm wrong about this, but you sit and look at all these the theatres that are gradually disappearing into Portuguese evangelist churches and whatever else. I hope that the success of downtown does not mean that a lot of those spaces will go. I fear it does.
None of them are going to real estate. I'm working with the owners of all but one of them, and we want you down here.
I went into the Million Dollar. I went into Los Angeles. We talked about that. We actually did talk pre-development. We were talking to the Orpheum. So there have been conversations with the owners as well.
Mm-hmm.
I've done preliminary investigation and came to the same conclusion, although Clara Kim, who's our gallery director, had a wonderful idea to animate them with visual artists' installations of some sort. And if the funding appeared for that, I think it would be a wonderful project. It would be, in perhaps 12 different locations along Broadway. What a great way to spend an afternoon or an evening.
I don't think anyone in our jobs needs selling on those spaces, because I will take artists on the tour and show artists the spaces. And I mean, it's a unique... I don't think there's anywhere else on the planet that I've come across where there are so many fantastic empty spaces in one place.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming, and I want to thank our two guests.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.